Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikulskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
I'm joined by Tim McGrath, who is out with a new biography of a very uncovered president. It's biography is James Monroe, A Life, and Tim joins me now. Tim, when I was in school, I always got assigned to do reports about presidents, and I always picked James Monroe because he and I share a birthday, April 28th. But what I was wondering is, you know, for you to jump into this presidential biography thing, what made him stand out to you? His story, his person, what?
Well, ironically, it was something with Penguin that after we did a book on the Continental Navy, our editor, Brent Howard, said, let's come up with something big. What about a president? We kicked some around, and I brought Monroe up, and he said, why? And like you, I said, well, you know, when I was 7 years old, he was my favorite president. You know, I'd been to Valley Forge, and he had stayed the winter there and learned about him being wounded as a teenager at Trenton. And as a history major, he was someone that, you know, you knew, but you didn't really dig into. And to be honest with you, Brian, digging into the research of that, I went, oh, my God, this is, how come nobody's written about this guy in any depth and detail? Just a remarkable life, a half a century of service to his country from the military through political through diplomatic and obviously becoming president. And that became the real push. And then, ironically, a couple of incidents with him, including really one of his wife, when they were in Paris and going by herself to try to help get Adrienne Lafayette, the Marquis's wife, out of prison before she joined her sisters and mother on the chopping block. So there were a lot of interesting stories, large and small, that just, you know, had me diving into this.
Well, where did James Monroe catch his political bug?
Probably through, I think, initially his uncle. His father died when he was young, and he had just started going to William and Mary, and he was the oldest son of four children, and actually five, one had died earlier. But he was at William and Mary right before the revolution started. So while he's down the street at Williamsburg at the campus, George Washington, Tom Jefferson, his uncle Joseph Jones, who was a very well-respected peer of theirs, and Patrick Henry, or I guess fomenting rebellion. While in the middle of all of this, it's Lord Dunmore, the royal governor, who was a very charismatic representative of the British Empire until things got it dicey, and then he really showed his true colors and his loyalty to his king. But, you know, to be in the midst of all that, I think it would be hard to not to be influenced by what was going on, especially when you're young and idealistic.
He was one of these Virginia founding fathers, but, you know, he had contact with all of the people that we know, Jefferson, Madison, those people. Where did James Monroe and Thomas Jefferson meet?
They might have met early around that time through his uncle, but they officially first met in 1778-79. Monroe had gone as far as he could in the Continental Army. The Army had a glut of Virginia officers, and Washington was loath to promote them. And so he asked to return to Virginia, maybe to join the militia. But he was at a point where he really needed a mentor, and he went to the governor's mansion and sat and talked with Jefferson, who immediately took a liking to him. He saw Monroe is extremely earnest and avid, obviously brave. He'd been seriously wounded at Trenton. And Jefferson invited him to study law under him, which was basically the way you went to law school. Can you imagine, you know, in this day and age, being able to start studying law with, you know, someone who would be like a Justice Roberts or a Sotomayor? It was pretty much the equivalent. So he clerked as a law student under Jefferson, while at the same time, because of his military experience, Jefferson used him extensively as a courier and almost like a reconnaissance scout whenever there was the threat of the British coming up from the Carolinas into Virginia. So he was very ably assisted that way. And then later in his career, when Jefferson left for France, he made sure that Monroe connected with James Madison, who age-wise was exactly in between the two. And that relationship started. So he got off to a good start with connections.
He was well-educated. His parents were both literate, which was fairly rare at the time. And so he's pursuing his education. His uncle gets him into William and Mary, or sends him to William and Mary. But there seemed to be always this constant threat of military service looming over all of his studies. So what did his military service look like as it kind of ran in the background of his studies?
It's a good question. Lexington and Concord, news of that reached Williamsburg a little bit at the end of April, and he was still in school, and he immediately enlisted in a regiment. The students were actually doing drills on the campus, and he was even involved in a situation where he was part of a group of students and townsfolk that assailed the governor's mansion and came out of it with a substantial amount of weaponry that he kept there and at the magazine. Monroe was made a lieutenant in the 3rd Virginia Regiment that summer. Another person in the 3rd Virginia Regiment was John Marshall, and ironically, both of them went to, I guess, a colonial version of a boys' prep school together before Monroe went to William and Mary. They marched up to New York in the late summer of 76. They arrived at Harlem Heights a day or so before Washington's disastrous defeat in New York. And then a couple of days later, after that, Monroe watched the city, Manhattan at least, catch fire. No one quite knows whether that was by the Americans or by loyalists. He had his first taste of battle at Harlem Heights, and then had a couple of other skirmishes at Mamaroneck, where their enemy was Robert Rogers, famous from the Northwest Passage book and movie, and I think he also is a villain in the Turn series for viewers that watch that. And after the fall of Fort Lee and Fort Washington and the retreat down to New Jersey, he writes in his own autobiography about witnessing the desertions, and at one point it's his job as a lieutenant to count the troops as they're crossing a bridge. And that's when he first describes encountering George Washington, this magnificent man riding at the end of the army, wanting to be able to see who's following them. And it left a lasting impression on him. He then volunteers to serve on Christmas Day as one of the two officers that crosses the Delaware hours before the main army does, along with a relative of Washington's, William Washington, who served with great distinction during the Revolution. And they wind up going towards Trenton hours before. So he really liked being in the thick of things.
I'm chatting with Tim McGrath about his brand new biography, James Monroe, A Life. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold. Tim, at the time of the Constitutional Convention, 1787, Monroe was not chosen as a delegate, and this caused him some great consternation. Where was he at the time?
He was actually serving in the House. He had just gotten married to a beautiful young socialite who probably is, Brian, the Jacqueline Kennedy of her day, as Monroe's career ascends. This very beautiful, well-educated, but a bit distant young lady that came from a very distinguished family in Manhattan. And he's annoyed, to be honest with you, that he's not able to attend the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. And Jefferson and Madison are very frank with them. They're both saying, look, you just got married. You have no money. You know, we're footing our own bill to do this. And he gets a little more miffed even when he's getting letters from both gentlemen about the convention, because they're forbidden to discuss what they're talking about inside Independence Hall. So, you know, he's very frustrated and back in Virginia. When the Virginia Ratification Convention is announced, Patrick Henry, who is leading the opposition to having a constitution, reaches out to Monroe, and it's ironic because he was one of the congressmen, even as a young man. He's 29 at the time, is very adamant that we need a new system of government. The Articles of Confederation are an abject failure. He saw that firsthand as a legislator. But he goes along with Patrick Henry, and Henry looks at, you know, handsome young guy, war hero, I can make him the face of the opposition. And his opposition is due to the fact that there is no Bill of Rights, and that's why he lands on the anti-side of it.
Monroe's presidency is known in a nutshell by many students today for the Monroe Doctrine. Would Monroe be proud of that one piece being his legacy for so many?
Yeah, I think he would be, Brian. I think he'd be very proud of it. It's finding that story and getting into the details of it was a lot of fun. There was a historian who wrote in 1923 to celebrate its centennial that he knew two things about the Monroe Doctrine, that nobody he talked to knew what it was about, and secondly, nobody wanted it messed with. But Monroe, one thing his presidency is marked for, it's a good sense of judgment. You know, he could hardly be the brightest guy in the room when your friends are Jefferson and Madison, but most people found him to be the soundest of the three, or in any room, for his judgment. He took his time, he got ideas, and he made his call based on a lot of input. And that was true with the Monroe Doctrine. There had been, since he was inaugurated in 1817, a lot of politicians, first and foremost Henry Clay, wanted the Latin American new governments recognized immediately. And Monroe was taking his time. And he waited and waited, and looking at how things were going, not just in South America, but in Europe, and with the demise of Napoleon and the insurrections that were going on in small countries in Italy, on the Italy boot, or with Greece, and Metternich and his approach to let's bring back the divine right of kings. Monroe sat with John Quincy Adams, and they basically hammered out together what the Monroe Doctrine became. And that's another great story. His relationship with Quincy Adams is just remarkable. They were not close friends, but you have to look to maybe Truman and George Marshall, and certainly H.W. Bush and James Baker as the only two other examples in our history where, you know, two people at the president and the secretary of state work so well together.
Well, that's just an amazingly entertaining book, and one of these founding fathers that we don't know much about, thanks to all the popularity of Hamilton, Jefferson, and those fellows over the years. So I'm glad you put this together. The book is James Monroe, A Life. Tim McGrath is the author. Tim, just a fantastic biography. I enjoyed it thoroughly, and thanks for joining me to talk about it.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me, Brian, and it's great to talk to someone out in my mom's home state, and I hope you and your family and your audience stay safe and healthy through this crisis.
Thank you. Same to you. The Pride of Muscatine, Tim McGrath. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
My honey, my baby, don't put my love upon no ship. She said, don't hand me no lines and keep your hands to yourself.